You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, catching me up on the, it seems like weeks and weeks I've been gone, the great David Dayen from Fire Dog Lake News. Also on the program today, well, Mitt Romney apparently still the Republican nominee for president. The Chicago teacher strike looks like it's going to be wrapping up. And Occupy Wall Street, having celebrated its one-year anniversary a day or two ago, David Dayen will tell us about a new organization that has spun off of one of the latest groups that have sort of come out of the Occupy movement. Also, as I predicted, I guess anybody could have predicted this. Not necessarily. Months and months ago, I said the thing to watch, I think I said this back in February, the thing to watch is when we start seeing the public declarations from Republicans that they are shifting their efforts to the House and the Senate. We have seen that now. From the presidential campaign, I should say. An indication of how problematic Mitt Romney is. I don't know. I mean, I do think that there is some... Well, I'll talk to Dave Dayen about this, but would you really be that far off if you just thought, like, maybe the Republicans just literally were just going to be happy with Obama this time? For whatever reason. Also on the program, Todd Akin. I didn't hear this anywhere. Maybe people talk about this already. Todd Akin's wife tried to defend him in perhaps one of the most offensive ways. I don't know. Maybe people are aware of it. I hadn't heard it. Of course, I was in a bubble. I will discuss on this program. Both we'll talk to Matt and Michael, who did a bang-up job covering the Occupy Wall Street one-year anniversary protest, which apparently were incredibly decentralized, but very well plotted out. 180 people, I think, got arrested. Is that right? About 180 people got arrested on Monday. I, of course, was in Massachusetts celebrating Rosh Hashanah with my daughter and my family. They're actually the same. My daughter is my family, I guess, but I'm talking about using my daughter as a barrier to the rest of my family. It's like a shield. She's like a human shield. We'll also talk later in the program about my experience hosting Up with Chris on Saturday and Sunday. Appreciate all of the kind words that people sent. A couple of things right up front, just to do a little house cleaning. We'll get to some stories in just a moment. We'll go to David Dayen. First off, want to remind you that Sunday at Public Assembly in Williamsburg, I don't know if someone my age is allowed to go to Williamsburg anymore. But at public assembly in Williamsburg at 6 p.m., StrangeAngels.com, who are sponsoring this program this whole month, and I think we still may have just a couple of more, I mean literally a couple more, they have basically come to us and said, we will give free trial memberships to listeners of the Majority Report just so that they can get a sense of what the better half of the program is, as a way of promoting the launch of StrangeAngels.com, which is a progressive-based, essentially, you know, like a matchmaking type of thing, you know, online dating service, but it's with human beings. Actually do the, there's no logarithm. And they're doing an event at Public Assembly in Williamsburg, 6 p.m. This Sunday, the 23rd. Go to StrangeAngels.com to check it out. And go. It should be fun. Also, I want to just wish a happy birthday to, is it to Pirates? Oh, no, it's to Kyle. It's to Kyle Shank. Of course, this show literally could not happen without Kyle. Like, literally. He did all the tech on this.
It's funny you mentioned Pirates, and it's his birthday today, because while it's not the same type of pirate, today is actually Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Right. Well, what do you mean same type of pirate? He's a pirate?
Well, he could be a pirate.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about the pirate that goes arr matey and the pirate that downloads software.
Oh, are you suggesting that he's someone? Oh, I don't know if he wants that spread around. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dave Dayan. Lots of stuff to catch up on today. Lots of sound, obviously. We'll be going through some of the Choice Romney clips. I had actually seen this some of this video last week, but wasn't sure if it was real. I think I had seen it when I was at the Up with Chris offices. But all right, let's go talk to Dave Dayan. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, I'm not on the phone. This is Sam Seder from the Majority Report. But on the phone is my pleasure to welcome back to this program. You know, I don't want him to get a swelled head, but he's one of my favorite guests. I read his stuff on Fire Dog Lake News every day and always wonder when and if he sleeps. Of course, I'm talking about David Dayan. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Now, David, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I took like 3 days off last week. I mean, I, of course, pre-recorded, and I was working, of course. I never am not working.
No.
But I didn't do the show live for those 3 days. And then I had to I took Monday and Tuesday off for family travel. And so my understanding is, there's a couple of things I want to get up to speed. My understanding is that Mitt Romney seems to be an incredibly bad candidate who nobody in his own party or his own campaign likes. And he also basically puts, I don't even know how to describe all this audio that's coming out from his from one of his big donors thing, but it's not just that he doesn't think that he's going to get the votes from people who he thinks are, I guess, leeches in society. He doesn't think that any of his proposals will help them either.
Right. Well, with all due respect, I think before your 5-day hiatus, we already knew that Mitt Romney was a bad candidate, and,
right.
and unsuited for this moment in history when, you know, the time after a crisis caused by the financial industry seems to not be a time when you hire the richest person ever to run for the presidency as your nominee. But, with regard to this this tape that has come out that Mother Jones tracked down, it's provoked a fairly interesting discussion. The discussion is actually more interesting on the right, because as you allude to, a lot of the reason that we have the situation we have today, where federal income tax, which is of course one third of all taxes that are paid, so the idea that you even isolate people that don't pay federal income tax, when there are so many other taxes that virtually everyone pays that are all regressive, things like sales taxes, property taxes, local, state and local taxes, payroll taxes, it is kind of absurd. But this idea that you have 47% of America who don't pay federal income tax, much of the reason for that comes out of policies Republicans supported and advanced and expanded, things like the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, ways that Republicans thought they could encourage and induce work rather than, I guess, welfare, by, through the tax code, providing incentives for people that work to then receive refundable tax credits in the form of funding. It's kind of a wage subsidy. So it keeps wages a bit lower at the low end, and can be sustained by the fact that people who qualify get you know, these cash transfers that are look like tax refunds, so that you know, lower tax is always good on the right. Until now, because we have this this situation where you have Mitt Romney denigrating people for becoming dependent on the state through this factoid that is being sort of mismanaged about 47% of Americans not paying federal income tax. And so these things come into tension, because what you're really talking about when you're talking about, you know, people who see themselves as victims and not taking personal responsibility and the culture of dependency, what you're really talking about is you, voter, pay taxes, and that other guy is making out with your money that you're paying into the system. And that other guy is black. I mean, in the most common version of this story, we're talking about something that's race-based, that's class-based, and that's based on this idea that has sold the Republican Party to the white working class,
right,
for some time.
Well, and it's interesting. Okay, I mean, put that aside, because that is definitely a an element of this. I mean, the other thing that is fascinating to me is that it is also an acknowledgement. I mean, there's two other things that it seems to implicitly acknowledge. One is when he says, you know, I got nothing to offer these 47%, right? Because I'm not giving my tax breaks don't appeal to them. Because they're not getting a break on their taxes. Now, the story that we've always been told about why Republicans want to have tax breaks is because it's not because people are shirking their responsibility. It's because this will grow the economy.
Right.
Right. This is how we expand the economy. And if we expand the economy, this is how we take care of poor people. Everybody's boat is lifted. It's the whole trickle-down theory. So
correct.
He is also in this moment saying that stuff, that's all, like, we just say that stuff. But we all know the reason why we give tax breaks is because people like tax breaks. And if they've already got them, then I've got nothing to give them.
I mean, that is why this has been more of an interesting fight on the right. because that is sort of the Jack Kemp theory,
right,
of how you grow the economy through, you know, these tax incentives that, you know, trickle down into and rise everybody up. And the fact that this inartful or inelegant comment really riled a lot of people on the right is because it does go against some measure of their fundamental ideology. But it also just shows, as I was sort of saying, getting at before, that their ideology is kind of in tension, because it's just as central, if not more central, to that ideology to set up this dichotomy between makers and takers. I mean, if you go to my site and Talking Points Memo today, you'll see this ad from 1972 that Richard Nixon ran against George McGovern, talking about his George McGovern's welfare plan, and uses the exact same number. He says, under George McGovern's welfare plan, 47% of America will be on welfare. And it's showing this picture of a construction worker eating his lunch and looking out onto the streets of New York, and the voiceover says something to the effect of, and if you're not on welfare, then you're going to be the one paying for it. And that's been central to conservative ideology, to sort of pit the working class against one another, to see people as getting special breaks, special incentives, special treatment, and that has been their political strategy. What you're talking about is their sort of economic strategy, their justification for this low tax mania. But their political strategy has really always been very much along the lines of what Romney was putting out there. And that's why it's so interesting, because what we've seen now is that those two things are just in fundamental tension.
Right. And that's why, you know, you're not supposed to hear the presidential candidate say that. That's the
right
chatter that we hear underneath, where his surrogates say that, because him saying it actually really does sort of create that tension. It is much harder. I mean, it's also, you know, look, the story that we're always told, okay, by and I'm veering into another story here a little bit about there was a quote by Ezra Klein in the story on Paul Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
The story that we're always told by those people who the establishment journalists,
right,
the supposed policy journalists that David Broder sort of claimed he was part of, right? We're just talking about serious proposals for serious solutions.
Right.
Always start with the assumption that the two ideologies, as it were, the differences between the parties, agree on some basic principles that they want to attain, right? That no one should go without certain things in this country. And the argument has always been, what's the best way to get there? Right?
Right.
I mean, the Republicans cannot run on the idea, or in the past have not run on the idea of, hey, poor people, they deserve it. I mean, they can't explicitly say this, right? They poor people, they deserve it. We don't care what our policies do to poor people, because if they're poor, it's their fault. No, the debate supposedly has always been, we have proposals, they have proposals, we think this is a better route to go. This also creates that tension, and maybe we're just saying, this is a different way of saying the same thing, but this also questions that fundamental assumption. If Mitt Romney gets up there and says, look, there are 47% of the population that don't pay federal income taxes because they're so poor, there's nothing I can do for those people. This isn't about those people.
Right.
You know, it's about the 53% that are left in America, and I'm going to champion their hopes and aspirations.
Right.
It really sort of lays bare the idea of that that we're all aiming for the same thing here. Do you know what I mean? That we're that there are similar policy goals, just different ways of getting there. And that seems also incredibly problematic. I think that's why sort of we're getting this response from even from people like Joe Scarborough and David Brooks and this and that, who are pissed that, look, you know, either, I don't know what's in their heart of hearts, but like that veneer is gone now.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some respect that you know, these conservative columnists, people like Brooks and commentators like Scarborough, they created this monster. I mean, over the last several years, we've seen an empowered group on the right, the base of the Republican Party, the Tea Party conservatives, who have definitely expressed this ideology that you described, the idea that the poor deserve what they're getting, and whether they live or die, I guess, makes no concern to us. And this has become the dominant ideology within the party. And the people who put forward an economic program that was maximalist, an economic program that said the best way to go about economic prosperity for everybody is through our policies of low taxes, supply-side economics that grow the economy and help everybody, and also empower people to help themselves, which is, of course, a core part of sort of the Republican mythology, that if you don't, you know, make people dependent on the state, that they become entrepreneurs and dreamers or whatever have you. So, you know, the problem is that those people are gone from the mainstream of the Republican Party. Right. They may be there in sort of the, you know, the economic policy fields, but in terms of the core base of the party, the group that put Republicans into the majority in the House, that ideology is not there anymore. And
right,
Romney,
we call them
former
Democratic
Republican
establishment in many yeah. respects. Right?
We either call them former Republican congressmen or we call them Democratic establishment, exactly. So
right. Erskine Bowles.
Yeah, so I think what Romney was doing was just sort of reflecting back what he has heard over the last year when he's trying to run as the nominee of a party that now firmly believes many of the things that he said in that speech. And that comes not just from the base of the party, but clearly, given the audience he was
right.
speaking to, from the very top.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I would have to say right now, as I look out on the American landscape, I would have to say the most encouraging thing that I can say about it is that the huge money donors of the Republican Party seem to be as completely clueless and out of touch as the same guys will show up at the Glenn Beck rally. And
absolutely. I mean, this goes back to something that was in Chris Hayes's book, which I'm sure you
right.
read. This social distancing that you get from elites that live, you know, basically in their own bubble. And cannot relate to the common struggles and the common problems of ordinary Americans because they don't even see them.
There was another quote that hasn't gotten much play from Romney, a little bit, but not that much. It was the story he tells about going to China with a bunch
right.
of his fellow Bain investors. And they see the horrible working conditions of these people in China. And they're told by the people who own the factory that, oh, we have gates up to keep people from getting in. The conditions
yeah.
here are so much better than they are anywhere else in China. Now, putting aside the validity of that part of the story, which may or may not be true, the lesson that Romney learns is, boy, everybody, if you're born in the United States, 95% of your work is done. Now,
right.
that certainly probably was his experience.
Yeah.
If you are born to the governor of a state or a chairman of a major car corporation,
right.
then yeah, 95% of your work is done. It's not quite the same for about 85% of the rest of the country. Maybe, you know, and That obliviousness is the same obliviousness that we've come to know and love of Mitt Romney. That's the same thing as, like, look, take a risk. Borrow 20 grand from your parents and go out and make a man of yourself.
Well, the other part of that, of course, is that it lays bare the bankruptcy of the entire "you didn't build that" comment, because implicit in the idea that you've done 90% of the job just by being born in America is that America and the American government offers so many opportunities through infrastructure, through education, through all of these things, that it helps people who do not have to be as self-reliant then to get ahead.
Indeed. I mean, that's the bottom line, right? I mean, and it's just a matter of degree from there. But the bottom line is, like, once certain things are taken off the table, you know, some basic things are taken off the table, you have certain advantages. And within the context of American society, more things are taken off the table for some people that has nothing to do with the fact, except for, you know, forgive the crassness, whose body they dropped out of, essentially. And,
you're right.
And when.
But, you know, also circling back to what you said about how this is true for some classes of people in America, but not everybody, clearly, you know, I got really annoyed by at the Republican and particularly at the Democratic convention. Julian Castro, not just him, but virtually everybody talking about these stories of how they you know, America allows this opportunity society and you can build yourself up through hard work and all of the people who said that on stage were the beneficiaries of that. But if you look at the reality, Americans, I believe, have the lowest social mobility, upward mobility in the entire industrialized world. And it's a selection bias. It's such a low subset of people when you're hearing from politicians who succeeded on a stage at a giant convention say that we think that America is great and we want to open up this opportunity for everybody. But that's just not the reality of how it exists on the ground, where your station in life is largely determined by where you begin, much more so than any other country in the industrialized world.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, that was wrote that into one of the pieces I did on Chris Hayes' show this weekend.
I know.
Because, you know, it was in particular, I mean, obviously, the Republican Party was wall to wall that. But
yes.
Julian Castro in particular struck me as echoing the exact same theme that the subtext being that, look, my parents or my mother, my grandmother, they worked hard and look at where I am now. The subtext is, if you're not either eligible to be standing on this stage or hugely successful, it sounds like your parents were just lazy.
they messed up.
The idea, you know, like, I'm convinced there was more than one grandmother of this generation who crossed that border, who did everything and had the same grit as Julian Castro's grandmother, but she crossed 5 miles south of where, Castro's grandmother was, and she fell into a ditch and broke her leg and then had an infection. And, or she ran into the wrong people, or dumb luck. Even, you know, aside from all the obstacles that come from people who are in that class, if you get out of the lesson to be learned is not just that your grandmother was really great. She was also tremendously lucky. And, you know, if you want to call it grace of God, or you just want to call it, like, you know, I hit the lottery, that factor never came into play. The idea that it was just about that, and that permeates Romney so much. And it also permeates a lot of what we hear from the Democrats.
It permeates the entire political class. And it's what's happened is that Democrats over the last several decades have basically said that the only way we're going to talk about equality in an economic context, not a social context, where they do,
right.
and much so, more so this year than almost any year at the convention, talked about social equality in really progressive ways. But as far as economic equality is concerned, the only way we're going to talk about that is in the context of equality of opportunity. You know, we will provide the opportunity for people to succeed if they want to, and we will make it sound like this is kind of a simple thing. If you work hard, you play by the rules, we will provide the opportunity for you to succeed and grow. And look at me. I did it. I came from nothing. So if I did it, then certainly you can do it. What we've gotten away from is equality of outcome. The fact that if we live in the society we live in where most people don't progress, despite these alleged opportunities available to them, that we're going to help them anyway, that they don't lose that economic lottery and then have to be thrown to the winds.
One of the major yeah. points of Hayes's book is that equality of opportunity is sort of bunk. Like it immediately yeah. gets corrupted. Like when it hits oxygen. You know, you can take it out of this sort of like hermetically sealed, you know, idea chamber. But as soon as you throw it out into oxygen, it gets completely, it gets immediately corrupted. I mean, one of the things that the producers on Hayes' show found was, you know, these ads from Johnson. And Johnson sitting there talking about the idea of people find themselves in situations through yeah. no fault of their own. Or through okay. circumstances beyond their control. That, I mean, the idea of saying that there are circumstances beyond their control only applies to people who live in China relative to America, according to Mitt Romney, not within the context of American society.
And just to fit this back to Romney and to look at that 1972 ad that I talked about, if you start talking about these things in the way that Johnson used to talk about them, the Republican counterattack was, well, you're just throwing a bunch of people on welfare, you're making them dependents, and we're having to pay for all these people. And that was an effective technique in the 1970s and through in the 1980s, and Democrats stopped fighting it. They stopped playing the game. They retreated, and they retreated back to this idea of equality of opportunity, and that's where we are today. Now, Romney, by saying such an extreme version of this, even though Democrats have largely walked off of this playing field, maybe that will start sparking some sort of change here. But what we have now...
Well, part of the problem is, too, is that we're just yeah. talking about tax credits.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
We're just talking about tax credits. And
right.
you know who's
That's
one of the
it
biggest...
Shifted. I mean,
one of the other...
72, yeah.
One of the
I'm
biggest,
sorry.
One of the biggest benefactors of the idea of tax credits or choosing winners and losers in the tax code is a guy named Mitt Romney, who pays 13.9% taxes simply because of the fact that he gets other people to invest in product.
Right.
And so, therefore, somehow... and really actually just into paper products, literally into financial instruments, debt, you know, loans, and he walks away with lower taxes because of it.
Sure. I mean, the truth is that
he doesn't
context,
pay any income tax either. He just pays capital gains taxes.
Right. He paid on interest and capital gains and dividend income and things like that. I think he had a little bit of income the year that we know about because he wrote a book.
Right. Okay. So
he might have had some actual income that year, but certainly not other years. But the point is that if you really want to talk about takers in this society, you have to bring in these trillions of dollars in tax expenditures in one author called the submerged state.
Susan Mettler, I think her name was.
Yes,
people
Susan
can
Mettler.
Search our archives for that interview.
Yes. All of these things in the tax code that benefits people who buy homes, that benefits people who put away money for their children's college, who have the money to save, you know, in Coverdell funds. Corporate welfare, the 18 small business tax cuts that Barack Obama likes to talk about all the time that he signed. All of these things The idea that there's only a narrow group of takers, and that's the people who don't pay any income tax, is silly. I mean, everybody's a taker, and some take a far bigger bite when they do their taking on the order of billions and billions and billions of dollars in tax subsidies and things of that nature. But you're absolutely right. We're only talking about taxes in this context, tax credits, whereas the discussion used to be about guaranteed basic income or wage subsidies or things of that nature.
And I didn't want to spend all this on Romney, so we'll just try and
right.
Well, let's also – he also went on to basically say some – I think maybe perhaps even more disturbing. I mean, they won't have the same political impact, but in terms of actually like sort of what a certain subset of serious people in Washington will sort of disqualify him from presidency is sort of his stance on Middle East peace. You know,
right.
He basically just said, like, I have no clue as to what our strategy is, and I'm willing to – I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe people take it less seriously because foreign policy doesn't, at least this day and age, doesn't seem to sort of play the same role right now in politics. But his comments on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I guess maybe they shouldn't be terribly surprising from where he's been. But this guy is just – he just seems clueless to me.
He basically said he's given up, he's bought the idea that there is no honest broker on the Palestinian side, that there is no one, no leader in Palestine that is willing to sign a peace deal in any respect, which is a very easy thing to say because then you don't have to actually negotiate at all. I mean, you don't have to pursue the peace process, which is very difficult. In any way, and you don't have to, think about the kinds of steps that Israelis are not willing to take because, well, they don't have a partner. So,
well, I mean, it's an easy thing for you and I to say, but if you're going to be the president of the United States,
right?
You couldn't say anything that is more detrimental to peace and stability. At least in the context of that conflict. I mean, it is basically saying, like, if I become president, I'm going to be in no position to do anything. Not just,
if
facts on the change, on the ground changes, he's still not going to be able to do anything. He is.
And if you're a Palestinian hearing that, what are your options? Your options are, well, we're never going to broker peace because the only group with the institutional muscle to be able to force that is the United States, and their president or their president-to-be is sitting here saying, you guys aren't interested in it, so I'm just not going to do anything. So what are the options for Palestinians? An intifada? I mean, there are no other options for them on the table other than certainly not through the channels, not that there are a vast array of options right now, given Netanyahu being the prime minister, but at least there was an attempt to try and getting back to honest broker. I mean, that is supposed to be the traditional role of the United States. And here you have a Republican nominee for president saying, contradicting his own party platform, by the way, which does call for a two-state solution.
Right.
Saying, I'm done. All we can do is manage this. All we can do is sort of kick the can down the road. We'll treat it like China and Taiwan. Because, those are completely analogous situations. Because there are troops sitting inside, the West, Taiwan right now.
It's absurd. And it is more of, I mean, it basically puts into context how irresponsible he was in terms of the Egyptian embassy and the Libyan embassy situation. It puts that in. Clearly, it's a pattern. In other words, a president, a guy who thinks that he's going to be president, should never, ever say there's no, even in theory, there can't be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians because you've just created an untenable.
You've started a war. Yeah,
essentially.
And with respect to the Libya situation, I mean, one of the really interesting things that came out yesterday at the beginning of this tape is Romney talking about how Reagan was able to use the Iranian hostage crisis to his advantage, and then he explicitly says, in some foreshadowing, if I have that opportunity, I will make use of it, essentially, saying that I plan to politicize any foreign policy crisis that happens between now and the election. And there he did.
Right.
When there was an actual foreign policy crisis, an international crisis, he put the accelerator on to try to exploit it as much as possible.
And he did a really bad job.
A really terrible job of it.
Let's talk. I want to talk a little bit about the Chicago teacher strike, but I know that you're
great.
Working on. Let's talk about this. You did a little piece on, obviously there's a lot of coverage out there about Occupy, but you mentioned a group of that is started up, sort of, you said, analogous to almost Occupy Our Homes, strike debt or debt strike.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about that, and then also talk to us to the extent that you can about that piece you're writing about the sort of next bubble that we're going to see, I guess, the financialization or bubble of the housing market.
Right. I'm working on a longer story about this sort of next speculative bubble that we're seeing. You know, if you just read straight housing analysis stories of that nature, they'll be very positive in terms of the housing market. And housing starts went up a bit today. Existing home sales went a bit up today. Everybody's happy, basically. Housing is the great success story right now in 2012 of the U.S. economy.
Really?
Someone should tell my house that. That would be exactly what you would hear if you were reading the business pages today and over the last few months. The reality of it is that a substantial percentage, perhaps most, of these home sales are coming from institutional investors picking up distressed properties. Now, they feel that there is maybe a bottoming out of home prices, and they're buying low and with the purpose of converting them into rental units and selling them at a higher price a couple years down the road.
How do institutions buy that? I mean, what is the financial instrument in which they buy it?
Cash. They're purchasing them.
So when you say institutions, what kind of institutions? Oh, okay, hedge funds.
I'm talking about hedge funds. I'm talking about investment firms, private equity firms, these kinds of groups, not just regular property management groups that are small and localized and in a particular neighborhood. We're talking about national groups from New York buying hundreds of foreclosed properties in Florida at one time.
How do they do that? Like, what is the mechanism in which they do that? They just have, like,
some... Well, one of the mechanisms is that they borrow money from the big banks to get the working capital to purchase all these homes. I mean, there have been hundreds of thousands. We've talked about, since there have been millions of foreclosures over the last 4 years, there's all this shadow inventory.
Right.
There are these homes that have not been put on the market that banks are sitting and holding, waiting for someone to give them enough money to make it cost-effective to sell them.
And by having a shadow inventory, it makes the non-shadow inventory, the inventory that we can see, it makes it seem more in demand because there's theoretically less of a supply. But in fact...
Simple supply and demand thing.
Right,
and this helps that because if these institutional investors are coming in and purchasing up all of those distressed properties, first of all, because they're purchasing them for cash, the only remaining homes... are not in that state, and the price bids up for those. And it also takes all that other inventory off the market. There are basically more people looking for less homes right now, and that's where you get the price rise, however slight it is. But it's really being driven. I mean, the percentages, I've been told, of sales that are going to these institutional investors are at the similar level of the housing bubble. Now, why is this a problem? It's a problem for a number of reasons. Number one, they plan to convert these all into rental units. They have no expertise in doing this. They live out of the state, complete across the country in
but
some
surely
cases.
They must have entities in the state, right? I mean, if you don't have
they do have property management entities, but they don't have necessarily a channel with which to see if they're doing a good job or not. I mean, the concern is that you get a bunch of absentee slumlords, and if the property management companies are problematic, they don't actually own the underlying property, so who do you appeal to get things done? That's number one. Number two, and far more disturbing, is that the plan here is that if you get people into these properties and they're giving you rental payments a month at a time, you have a steady stream of income. Well, they want to securitize that income. They want to turn that income into bonds that can then be sold on the market. And they want to have big banks help them in that process. So here we have a situation that is exactly analogous to what we saw during the housing bubble. During the housing bubble, we saw mortgages pooled up, put into securities, sold all over the world. Now we have rental revenue being pooled up, packaged into securities, sold all over the world. We haven't started it yet because the credit rating agencies say, I don't know how to even rate this. But it's possible. I mean, we are seeing the beginning stages of this. We're seeing the discussions happen on how to securitize this rental revenue and package them into securities. And there is a sucker born every minute, I'm told.
Isn't rental revenue, though, is sort of intrinsically more stable?
Yes,
it is.
And no.
I guess it is if you have somebody in there, but there's no guarantee.
Exactly. There's no guarantee, number one, that people will stay in there to the degree that has been promised by these investors.
Right.
And certainly if there's another recession, if there's another problem, you're going to see more vacancies as household formation drops. Because people don't have jobs and can't afford the rent anymore. That happens too. And if there are just vacancies for a longer period of time, then it becomes a problem in terms of delivering a steady stream of revenue, which is what is being promised here. Also, eventually, the goal is to sell these things. So if these investors keep pushing up the prices, which are still not at historical levels. I mean, they're still above historical levels, even though the housing market has crashed so much. It sounds crazy, but the bubble was so high that we're still sort of above the historical norm. If this new speculative bubble starts building housing prices up more, you're going to get the similar kind of crash when they all try to go and sell them in 2, 3, 4 years down the road.
And we should say that this is materially different than sort of traditional house buying, in the sense that traditionally people didn't buy a house for 3 or 4 years. Traditionally, I don't know what the percentage breakdown was.
Bought it to live in. Yeah.
They bought it to live in for an extended period of time. It was only during the sort of the bubble where people started to buy it to flip it. And these is basically just a huge. This is like we're gonna see a whole new rash of flip this house. It's just gonna be like, you know, for 3 years, try and rent it and securitize the rent.
Exactly. And you know, some other problems are the fact that single-family homes, which is what is being bought to then rent out, require more upkeep than, say, apartment buildings, where you only have, you know, a problem in one place at a time, potentially. That's number one. And number two is that when you have all of this, these single-family homes being rented out, if it's so much property, because we've had this just rash of foreclosures, the stat that I've been told is that in the city of Oakland, 42% of all the foreclosed properties have been bought up by these institutional investors. And they're edging out people who would want to buy in those neighborhoods who are individuals because these investors have cash. They seem, you know, it's more reliable to get your full cash value immediately. So they're buying up all these properties. And, you know, one potential outcome of that is that this turns into a giant redevelopment scheme. That entire neighborhoods change. The character of them changes. That there are so many houses on a block that have been purchased by the same investor or the same group of investors that they just completely rip up the neighborhood.
Right, and it could theoretically turn into, you've got just a tremendous amount of absentee landlordism, which I'm sure correlates into sort of a slow descent of a neighborhood.
Exactly. You know, there are studies about the differences between home ownership and renting. There are studies about, you know, this type of situation in terms of when you have so many landlords like this, especially out-of-state landlords. It's very concerning. We're building this narrative that housing has recovered, or that it's not falling anymore, and that this should be something to look to as a positive for the U.S. economy. But nobody is looking at, well, what does this housing market actually look like? And what does it look like for people living in it? That's where it brings up this series of questions.
Okay, so in 30 seconds, David, how can my audience hedge against this and make a fortune with no money down?
Well, it would have to be getting a very favorable loan from your local bank and purchasing. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad idea for individuals to buy at the bottom of the market and then rent out a place if they have the working capital. The problem is when you get hedge funds involved in it,
right,
when you get banks who have a desire to help with this because they're working on the securitizations and they've lent the money to the banks. And what does the end game look like when somebody doesn't pay their rent and it's part of a securitized bond that the money has to get over to the investors who have paid for that securitized bond? What does that look like?
Lower rents, maybe, but also dumpier places, right? Because, you know, we put you
well,
in here.
Well, I mean, what are the threats that are going to be put on people who don't get their rent in on the first of the month when there are people all around the world and people on Wall Street who are demanding that money?
Right.
That's kind of what I mean.
Well, I guess it was the wrong week for me to take a couple of days off. David Dayan, thank you so much for getting us updated on that. I guess I will discuss the Chicago strike in the better half of the program, as
there
it were, although this was quite a good half of the program. Thanks so much, David Dayan. You can check him out at firedoglake.com. Hit the news at the top of the menu bar. Thanks again, David.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. There I will talk about the Chicago strike. Union officials, apparently, I think they're back at school today. Is that right? They're back at school today. I got to dig into this. I'm not exactly sure of all the details. That's why I thought David was going to come on and tell me. We didn't even get there. So much I missed. Also, in the better half of the program, I will talk about that comment from Mrs. Aiken if you haven't heard it. We will play the audio clips that we were talking about with David Dayan because I want to break them down a little more specifically. Also, our long national nightmare over processed chicken and where to eat it seems to have come to a close. Also, a ruling in the Pennsylvania voter ID case. Not a resolution, but indeed a ruling. We will talk about that when we get back as well. If you want to be part of this program, 646-257-3920. You can call in. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, if you have not – first off, let me say, if you have signed up to be a member in the past 6 or 7 days, we are behind because Hillary hurt her hand and – Michael's not up to total speed on the tech side, and I was caught up in prepping for the Hayes show. So I want to apologize to you personally. Know that you will always have access to the member archives. As soon as we give you the stuff, we should have just about everybody signed up in the next 24 hours. Same too, if you have asked us for one of the free month-long membership trials of the Majority Report, we will get to those. So all apologies. Bear with us. Sometimes times are a little more difficult. Myla, Nikki's in production right now, so that means that I'm on double daddy duty. In instances when I would pawn the kid off to the wife, I'm being facetious. I would never do that. Please bear with us. Like I say, you can support this program by becoming a member, and we will certainly hook you up quite soon. You can also support this show by heading over to strangeangels.com if you're interested in if you do online dating, if you've never done online dating, if you're interested in helping people who are doing online dating, head over there. Justcoffee.coop if you're interested in coffee or tea or chocolate and like to ingest those things, but you also want something that is fair trade. You don't want to rip anybody off or exploit anybody as you're enjoying that coffee. It's a co-op. That's why it's justcoffee.coop. You get 10% off using the coupon code MAJORITY. That entire experience, it makes a wonderful gift, given the Majority Report blend. Not as bitter as the WTF blend, as we like to say. Give us a review on iTunes if you listen to the show via iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com. Do you buy your crap through Amazon? If so, go to majority.fm/support the show. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it. You never have to know another thing again except for buy through that link. You'll never know a difference. You'll be supporting the program in some fashion. All right, folks, we will see you in the better half. You can IM me at majority.fm or at majorityfm@jabber.org. If you are on some other IM clients, again, you can call the program 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a brief musical interlude. I hope you've noticed that Matt has begun including other songs, right, into the breaks?
I have.
Have you really?
Not today, but I have right. In the previous ones.
Yes, let's keep that, don't slow your roll, as we would say. 20 years ago.
I have the song files. I just didn't have them loaded in the soundboard we use for the live shows.
I understand.
So I have to load those in. But there were new songs on the pre-tape shows.
Yeah, we'll talk about the work you guys did out there. I heard very good things. We'll talk about why I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed it.
We got a lot of good feedback. All right, folks, see you on the better half.